Hello, you're listening to WGXC 90.7 FM Accra, Transmission Arts on Air. My name is Tony Katenjian, and I'm the editor-in-chief of The Unobserved, an online radio magazine that gathers, selects, and presents some of the best radio and audio from around the world. We believe in the power of great stories dynamically produced and told, and we have a growing collection of those on theunobserved.com, so please visit. This month on The Unobserved, we're going to present you with two pieces from two different parts of the world. The first hails from Canada's Karma Jolly, a producer for the CBC who made a beautiful piece about voice and identity called Middle Sea. The second is from London's Alan Hall, whose Falling Tree Productions created the piece Still Points Turning Worlds, about the stillness that is so difficult to find in our ever-evolving, ever-changing world. I'm proud to present both these exceptional works to you today. When Tristan Whiston was a little girl, she had an exceptional voice. She performed as a solo soprano at the age of 6 and went on to develop an extraordinary career with her voice and talent. But deep down, she always knew something wasn't quite right. She knew she wanted to be a man, was meant to be a man. So as an adult, she began a process of gender reassignment. But as a result, she had to let go of another key part of her identity, her voice, and her career. Award-winning Middle Sea tells the story of Tristan as she becomes a he, and the consequential results of that. Following Middle Sea is Alan Hall's Still Points Turning Worlds. In our oversaturated, overwhelming, and sonically explosive society, it can be difficult to find a moment of stillness, of quiet. Still Points Turning Worlds attempts to illustrate the struggle not only through the words of the characters within it, but also through the sheer composition of the piece itself. Alan Hall has won 2 Prix d'Italia's for his work. So on today's edition of The Unobserved on WGXC Transmission Arts, Karma Jolly's Middle Sea and Alan Hall's Still Points Turning Worlds. Let's start with Middle Sea. Enjoy.
This image in my head of a big ocean. One shore is woman and one shore is man, and I feel like I kind of exist somewhere in the middle, in the ocean between the shores.
I am starting today my radio diary, where I'm gonna basically record my singing as it changes as I transition from female to male. My voice has changed throughout my life. I had a child's voice, and then I went through my first puberty. Puberty was a very difficult time for me. I really shut down in many ways, and my voice actually, strangely enough, which had always been a soprano, went very low, and so I started singing alto. When I was about 18, my soprano voice reemerged, and that's the voice that's pretty much been with me, say, since I was 18. So, you know, 18 years. And soon, I'm gonna start testosterone, and my voice is gonna change. And, you know, at this very minute, thinking about that, it feels a bit scary. It feels like there might be some loss.
I
My name used to be Ruth. That's what I was christened, Ruth Margaret. The story goes that when I was born, the doctor said, "What are you going to call her?" And my mother said, "We've decided to call her Ruth." And the doctor said, "Bruce. That's a funny name for a girl." So I've always thought, yeah, you know, that sort of gender conflict was my introduction to the world.
Here's Ruth just appeared down. It's 10 o'clock at night. She's just going to sing a song for Grandad.
To a cowboy, all dressed in red, fell off his horse and fractured his head. Blood on the saddle, blood on the ground, great big blobs of blood all around.
Well done!
Well, the very first time I remember that we ever thought that you had a voice, you were 2 years old. And my father picked us up at Manchester Airport in England, and we're travelling along in the car, and all of a sudden this little voice started to sing, "Come by, oh my Lord." And my dad, who was quite a good singer, said, "Now who's that?" He was absolutely amazed that you had such a beautiful voice at 2 years old. And you like to perform, you like to be in the church choir at 6 years old. When you couldn't even read, you wanted to be in the junior choir, and we managed to finagle you into that, despite the leader's misgivings, and you sung a solo, your first Christmas there. You did wonderfully well. It was sung perfectly in tune, and you were 6 years old.
Like, as a kid, every day I had battles for really quite simple things. Like, I can remember going to nursery school and my mother put a barrette in my hair, right in the middle of my head. The idea of walking up the steps and walking in to my nursery school class with this barrette in my hair seemed mortifying to my four-year-old self. It was just so upsetting, and I was like crying and crying, "Please, please, mommy, please take it out. As we were, you know, walking up the steps to the nursery school, she kind of reached down and took it out, and then it was like, you know, the sun shone again for me, and it was like, wow, I dodged another bullet.
I don't know if you want me to say this, but I used to say to your father that I think something dropped off when you were born, because I always thought you should have been a boy. I just think you had more of the appearance of a boy than a girl. When your grandmother came from England to visit and she would take you to buy you a dress, as she always had to do, we used to go into absolute fits of laughter in the store, because you'd go behind these little swinging doors and you'd be giggling to yourself behind there, and then you'd come out with this dress on, and you'd stand, and you didn't look pretty like a little girl. You looked like somebody who shouldn't have a dress on, and you hated it. You absolutely hated it. And it was particularly obvious when you got to about 11, 12, and your body started to change, and you always said to me, "I wish I was 9 again."
About 12, like, we were all playing football like we always did, and me and all the boys of the neighborhood of Lockerbie, and they were picking teams, and I was the last one to be picked. That was like a first for me in my 12 years, that I was the last one to be picked. And somebody kind of reluctantly said, you know, "Who's going to take Chubbs? Who's going to do this incredible favor? Who's going to make the sacrifice of taking a girl?" I looked over at my brother. All I remember is seeing him turn away, look really embarrassed. And that was it. That was it for me in, like, my boyhood. It was like a seam being ripped apart. You know, it sounds so dramatic, but it was dramatic. It was the moment when I really learned what it was going to be like to be me. That's it. I'm not a boy.
White, I cannot get o'er, and neither hope.
You know, and then for years it was like, wow, it's like I went to sleep. You know, I went to sleep and I was this boy. And somehow I woke up as a woman and I did not know who that was. And a few years later, I called my mother and had that talk with her where I said, there's something you should know, I'm a lesbian. And the first thing she said was, well, you've always wanted to be a boy. And I was like, what are you talking about? Who says that, you know, I want to be a boy? I'm a lesbian, you know. I was actually, you know, for a couple of years, really finding something about being a woman that I could sort of relate to for the first time. And a few years after that, I was like, well, maybe I can explore the being a boy. And I did. And I kind of, you know, adopted a bit of a boy character. It was like so wonderful to really, like really have this feeling of like another kind of coming out, but also refinding this adolescent boy that I felt so at home with.
I am sailing, I am sailing home again, cross the sea, I am sailing.
I do realize that you have really lived as a boy for a long time, and so it's probably going to be a relief to you to actually do it properly, you know, do it finally. So, transitioning doesn't really shock me like it might have done if I hadn't always had that thought in the back of my head.
And how did Dad react when you told him? Did you told him?
I told your dad, and I think he was a bit shocked. And I said, well, and he didn't really say anything. And once he did say to me, I hope I'm dead before this happens. But it's something, it's out of our realm, really. We don't live in Toronto. We don't live where a lot of people are transitioning. And, you know, we don't move in those circles. Everybody we know's got, you know, kids and grandkids.
There was something about hearing that my father would rather be dead than to kind of live with me through my transition. It just sent me really to a real place of like, I'm such a freak. Like, what am I thinking? It just brought up a lot of really old kinds of feelings about not being the right kind of child, not being a girl that they could be proud of. I think my relationship with my mom will actually improve. Strangely, I think that it will actually improve. I don't know about my relationship with my dad. I don't know about my relationship with my brother. I haven't even told him yet. And those are important relationships to me, and I feel a bit like, well, they're in jeopardy. And that does feel like a high price to pay. But staying as a woman in this world, growing older as a woman in this world, feels like a much higher price. In a week's time, I will get my first testosterone shot. Yeah, I'm scared. And I'm excited. I feel like I'm actually just in a suspended place of waiting. And so mostly I'm really just like not thinking about it too much. And thinking about it all of the time. At the beginning of any journey, a ship sets sail.
Okay, I'm ready.
At the point of departure, there's, you know, all this hoopla. There's like ticker tape and there's rice being thrown and people are cheering. And
okay, so basically I'm going to go into a muscle in your buttock. So I need you to take your pants off, just kind of drop them down to below hip level.
It's possible at the other end of the journey there'll be people waiting, you know, friends and family, and there'll be some celebrations then too.
No, I'm going to inject the testosterone in. And you might feel a little bit of a pinch. Shouldn't be very painful. Okay, it's all in and we're done. How was that?
Good.
Okay.
But in between here and there, in between this shore and that shore, the boat just chugs along. Chugs along. I would say it was a little anticlimactic getting my first shot. I'd been waiting for it for a long time. You know, I guess some part of me maybe expected that, you know, I'd get my shot of testosterone and it would be like a thunderbolt or a lightning strike and everything would be different and I'd be like the person I want to be. To be honest, I didn't feel anything at all on a physical level. I got the shot and it was kind of like, oh, right. Things happen slowly. They happen in a certain sequence and they happen over time.
It really just struck me in a real way that my voice is going to be changing. But it just really struck me. I don't have unlimited time with this voice.
I don't really think it'll impact my life very much. Some people might think it rather strange, but I just think I'll have two sons and a daughter instead of two daughters and a son. I'm more concerned about how it would impact upon your life.
Can you hear me? Can you hear me? Home again, cross the sea. So it's just been over a month that I've been on testosterone. Not really noticing any big, drastic changes. But there's something changing in my heart. There's like a lightness, a sense that I'm doing the right thing. I've been checking out my face to see if there's any facial hair growing in or anything like that. I'm going to have to shave soon, and that feels really exciting. Like, it feels like a bit of a thrill.
To be with you, to be free.
As a kid, you know, my brother and I both had kind of fake razors, and my dad would give us his leftover bottles of Old Spice, and we would have these rituals every night after our bath. We would stand in front of the mirror and kind of foam up and then take our fake razors and shave and then slap on our Old Spice afterwards. You know, then ride our towel horses down the hall to dry.
Your brother? I imagine that Andrew's reaction will be, if I don't think about it, it'll go away, because if he doesn't like the idea of something, that's what he thinks.
Right.
So that's how he reacts to things. So I imagine he'll react the same way, but he doesn't want to know.
I am sailing, I am sailing home again, cross the sea.
My voice is breaking, not like a melting of ice that happens kind of consistently. The whole middle of my voice feels a bit like cheesecloth, like I'm singing or I'm talking and it just feels gravelly and holy, like I've smoked, you know, way too many cigarettes and drank bottles of whiskey, and I wake up the next morning and I'm like, hello.
I wonder about how your partner would feel. I wonder about going into men's washrooms. I'm sure that you've thought about it. You've been thinking about this for a good few years. You're a sensible person. So no, I'm not really worried about you.
Using the public bathrooms for me, it's always been a bit fraught because invariably if I go into a women's bathroom at a public space, I get looked at, hassled, told I'm in the wrong bathroom. But I can be kind of like, oh, no, it's your mistake. There's a certain safety. I can sort of reach back and, you know, it's kind of like, well, if I need to, I can prove it. Up to this point, I have been continuing to use female bathrooms. And yesterday, it felt like today I can pass for a guy. So I went in and I just kind of swaggered in, and there's nobody else in it, so I kind of felt safe. But then just as I was coming out, a bunch of men came in and I just felt a little bit scary. So I kind of washed my hands really quickly and just kind of swaggered out. Can you hear me? Can you hear me? I'm catching sight of myself in mirrors, and I don't exactly recognize myself right away. I like what I see. I like the way my body's changing. I love the muscles. I love the broadening of the shoulders. My walk is changing. The way I smile feels like it's changing. There's more confidence in myself moving through the world. I feel like I'm really stepping into something that's very, very truly me.
Okay, so I'm gonna shave now. It's the shaving cream. So, I don't know who teaches guys how to shave, but I feel like I'm a little late in the game to be learning. I guess dads probably teach their sons how to shave. Our older brothers, maybe. Oh, I'm self-taught.
I haven't talked to my dad really since May. My brother, I've sent 2 emails letting him know that I'm transitioning and I haven't heard back. I feel like I'm a bit of a, you know, I'm on a ship sailing solo through the sea. And, you know, I'm leaving people behind on one shore, and some of those people will be on the other shore when I get there to welcome me home, and some of them won't. I am sailing, I am sailing home again, across the sea, I am sailing. My voice is finally broken. So, mixed singing, not that much fun right now. I really can't sing. It's makes me feel really vulnerable.
I used to think it was kind of strange, and it is strange. I mean, it's different than what we were brought up as. You know, we always thought if you were male, you were male, and if you're female, you're female. But I think if it makes you happier and more comfortable with yourself in your body, then it doesn't matter what other people think anyway, does it? That's your life.
I booked chest surgery for November 11th. I'm having my breasts removed and my chest reconstructed to be male. I'm not feeling any loss about my breasts per se. I don't feel any connection to my breasts. They feel like they don't belong with me. I'll lose sensation
in that area of my body. Like, I won't be able to feel anything anymore. That feels like some loss that I'm having to kind of swallow a little bit. But I'm learning more and more in this life as a trans man that you can't have your cake and eat it too. There's a choice to be made at every turn, and in order to move forward with one thing, something has to be left behind. I am sailing, I am sailing home again, across the sea.
I did mention it to Andrew, but you know what Andrew was always like? If he didn't want to hear something, he put his hands and his fingers in his ears and said, "Dad, dad, dad, I don't want to talk about it." Well, that was kind of, it was a bit more mature than that, but not much. So up to now, he's not really said anything. I think you and Dad get on a lot better than you did when you were supposed to be female. He seems to relate well to you. He's happy to see you when you come to visit. We've seen a lot more of you. You seem more settled down, more focused.
Do you notice any differences in the way I look or sound?
Your voice is a little deeper. Look, you do look more masculine. You've got broader shoulders now. More masculine shape, more chunky. Not fat, but more chunky. We don't think any less of you because you're male than you're female. So.
Yeah, that's good of you.
Oh, you're still our kid, right?
Somebody asked me the other day, you know, if I consider myself a trans man or if I consider myself a man. And I said I consider myself a trans man because I bring with me those 37 years. 1 year on testosterone doesn't mean those years disappear.
I am sailing home again, across the sea.
I imagined that the change would be a smooth sailing from point A to point B to point C, from she to he to me. This year, I've had one eye peering into the road ahead, scouting out new terrain, searching and celebrating a long-awaited new whisker. And one hand is reaching back, just to check, just to see, is that part of me still there? Can I still claim that as me?
It is March the 21st. Today, it's April 20th.
It's May the 2nd.
It's June the 27th.
It's July the 11th.
It's Tristan and it's August the 18th.
This is Tristan and it's
September the
23rd. This is Tristan
and it's October the 15th.
Tristan, it's November
Hi,
the 3rd.
Hi, this is Tristan. It's December the
Hi,
10th.
Hi, this is Tristan and it's April. And I've now been on testosterone for 1 year.
To be free.
My voice, my speaking voice and my singing voice have changed quite a lot. And I've changed quite a lot. And I don't feel like I've changed at all.
Thank you for listening to The Unobserved on WGXE Transmission Arts. The piece you just heard was by Canadian radio producer Karma Jolly, and it is titled Middle Sea. Now, Alan Hall's Still Points, Turning Worlds.
10.
After you, come on.
Morning, everybody.
Morning.
Nice to see you. 9.
Just a traditional way, balanced, upright. With the eyes closed. and immediately be aware of the inner space.
So this is the music room. Well, it's a tiny little room with two very old tape machines, very old guitars and very old banjos, some of them really cheap and some of them expensive. But this is a 1967 guitar, and it looks suitably battered, and it's got Simplicade written on tape.
Eight. And watch any movements of the mind. And settle in the inner peace of yourself.
Deeper relaxed.
I just go down the steps of St. Paul's, the West Steps, are an amazing place because there's always lots of people sitting here and they always speak at least, you know, 20 different languages. So as you walk up, you can often hear anything from Korean to Chinese to Italian to Spanish. It's a fantastic kind of world, gathering of the world. As you come into the cathedral, you can also hear the kind of change in atmosphere, I guess, but also there's still lots of people speaking lots of different languages. As you start to come in, you can start to hear people talking.
Seven.
Quiet time. Two or three times a week we gather together, the whole school, and the other times of the week they do it in their classes. Particularly on Monday mornings, they come in and they're very agitated. They've probably spent the weekends on their Game Boys or emailing each other or something of this nature, listening to all sorts of things musically. And you have to spend quite a long time just getting them to a point where they can attend on something. So you have to be sort of open-hearted and generous and just encouraging towards stillness. And maybe in the midst of the 10 minutes, you may get a couple of minutes of absolute inner quiet, but the rest is sort of getting there. By comparison to where their minds have been, it is an oasis. And we only have one rule, which is very simple. If you just have one of something, it's simple. And that is that you do not disturb the peace of another man. But they get the great contrast between the world of utter movement and relentless pressure and come back to some sort of sense of an inner presence, an inner knowing, and an inner peace. And so it's beautiful. It's the best part of the day.
Six. More and more deeply relaxed.
The pause happens at the beginning and the end of every lesson.
It's the sort of point of stillness idea.
It allows you to sort of stop. Yeah, everyone daydreams, and I'm not saying they don't, but when you do daydream, you lose sight of what you're actually learning.
Just to flag up that half-term grades are due by Monday, and...
Five.
Do you know, that kind of annoys me, actually, that I'm forced into having my lovely music stuff next to my kind of printer and all my notes and my council tax bills. But unfortunately, that's the way it goes.
And then we get to the west end of the cathedral. We've got a huge font in front of us, great marble font. And there's lots of candles around where people simply come and light a candle and have a moment's pause and a moment's quiet before they go into the main part of the cathedral.
And it took me actually quite a long time to get used to it. I moved here about 3 years ago, birth of a daughter. It's really, really quiet out here. We're out in the burbs, out in Surrey. And I don't know how long it took me, but I was definitely a bit on edge for a while, having lived in zone one, basically, or zone two for 10 years in London. And now I go into London and I'm a bit harassed. You know, it's like, if you look out here, we're looking out over a big kind of valley, I suppose. There's not very many people around, which is, there is in the little kind of town down there, but walking around, it's just the sound of, I guess, birds and kind of various bits of gentle suburban sort of to-ing and fro-ing, really.
Om Paramatmane Namah. Good, stamp this. With every number I count, you'll become more relaxed, deeper.
So if we walk, continuing to walk further east, we're going now to the high altar area of the cathedral and the choir stalls.
Deeper relaxed.
So now we're up in the choir stalls, and the wood carving that surrounds us makes it a much more intimate space. It's darker. There are the fantastic mosaics above our heads which tell of the creation of the world, so the birds of the air, the fish of the sea. There's a lot of creation kind of pouring out of the walls. There's flowers and there are angels, there are mice, there are bunches of grapes. It's a kind of riot of creation. Visually, it's quite a busy environment, and orally, it's quite still.
Deeper still.
I'm still write as much music as I did then, and I probably write quite a lot, but it's definitely changed the kind of music. So when I was in the middle of things, I'd sort of write probably more edgy music, or more kind of more edges to it, you know, sort of more sharp and more kind of perhaps like a bit grittier on your ear. I've definitely kind of got more into kind of country and just kind of more acoustic sort of rounded sounds since I've been out here, which I presume is probably my pace of kind of life in some ways kind of slowed down. But it's funny, I think you've just as many still moments in the middle of the racket if you're the kind of person who, some people can't bear still moments, I think, you know, they have to be working or, consciously working. And I'm probably the other extreme. Even in the middle of kind of rackets, I've always sort of found time to kind of daydream or just sort of zone out a bit.
Silence is absolutely vital to the flourishing of human sensibility, for the flourishing of ourselves as people. We're people who want to try to communicate, and we mostly do that by making noise. But silence is not a negative. It's a very rich and fruitful and creative part of our lives. I happened to take myself off last summer for a month in silence. I spent a month in North Wales following the spiritual exercises of St. Ignatius Loyola. And the depth of silence that seemed to happen to me and in me, it was an extraordinary experience. And it became quite difficult to speak, because I discovered that attempting to speak was very deeply connected to my emotions, and I wasn't really quite sure what I was going to say or if I was going to be able to say anything at all. And to start with, it was a negative thing. I was not doing something. I was not speaking. I can't remember how long it took, but it took some time for that dynamic to shift, so that in the end it became that I was doing something. I was doing silence. So it actually shifted. My whole centre of gravity shifted. I loved the silence. I didn't really find it too difficult. He's going to practice.
there is another place we could go.
Laying on shore, I think about Superman. And maybe live round drinking, telling his friends. Reaper in his hands, amen. Someday gonna make a big splash. Oh, is that kind of dog? Just come to us, pulpit. Can't find ass on chest. So just keep wheeling, dealing. Bust, stop dreaming. Laying on the floor, just staring at the ceiling.
I'm the managing director of Metronaps UK.
Three.
Corporate fatigue solutions, essentially.
Two. One. All the way down.
And I'm introducing the energy pod, as we call it. This is the slightly space-age-looking craft in the corner of the room, but I'll take you over and show you around. Does look a bit like a stormtrooper hat at the back, with a sort of club class airline seat sticking out of the bottom of it. As you can see, it bends down into the sort of where your bottom would be before it raises up to where your knees are and then tails away. What that means is that you, by raising your feet, it makes it much easier to take a nap during the day. The bend in the knees and the contour of the seat also make it ergonomically correct and help support the muscles in your lower back. What you do after that is, as you climb into the energy pod, you lift up one of the arms and climb in. We then suggest that people raise their feet through the mechanism that we've installed on the control panel, so it's roughly level with your heart. What you want, by raising your feet to the level of your heart, you improve your blood circulation, and it also helps you to sleep during the day. So once you've raised it up, you can then sit back and relax inside the energy pod. As you can see, the control panel here on the right with a large LED display means that you can set the timer. So what we suggest to people is you set it for 20 minutes or maybe even a couple extra minutes, especially if you're new to napping. After that, you can then put on the music. We have a music button and adjust the volume to your left, place on the headphones, and then you sit back and relax and listen to the music.
Oh, yeah. And being deeply relaxed, you may like to allow your mind to wander to a favourite place you've been to.
Sometimes I do meditation to help me get to sleep and just rest my mind, put things on shelves, as it were, in my mind.
You, like, find a place where you know that you're still.
If I tried to remember where my mind goes, I'd bet I'd get it wrong. I'm remembering the bits that may have produced something, or you know. But I think the reason is that you relax a bit and you go off and you look at things from different angles. I presume it flits around all over the place. I think that's the point of those moments, is that you're not monitoring yourself. That's kind of what I think. So I think it's your mind just going off and different. I suppose close enough to a dream state or something.
Hello, Lucy. How are you?
We're going to nip into the Dean's vestry, if that's okay. And just have a bit of... Thanks, James, very much.
We'll talk about the day over here on Tuesday.
Fabulous. Does the Dean come up trumps?
Yes, he did. Yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
Oh, dear,
the
trousers here. Anyway, keep quiet.
Okay, yes, this is the Dean's Vestry, where all the clergy gather before services, and we put on our robes and get ready, and then we go out. So this is my cupboard, where all the robes are kept. It can be quite busy in here. It can be quite bustly with everyone getting ready, and we're getting instructions for what the service is going to be and all the rest of it. And then times like this, it's quiet, which is really nice.
Because obviously life is obviously getting stressful. Life is always, you know, moving at a faster rate than you're ever moving.
Taking a moment, stop everything, stop thinking, chill out, break, pause, and then go.
Because you've stilled yourself, you're still, and you're seeing everything moving around you. You're seeing everything much more clearly.
You can just watch the world go by.
It may be a memory, but always surrounded by something that you enjoy.
Well, I'm doing this kind of music therapy stuff at the moment, and either at the start or at the end is we'll sit around in silence, all 25 of us strangers, and it's rarely ever gets going. You know, somebody has to, like, just move something, clink, or that phone, or just rustle. It's like some people just really can't bear it, you know.
I think one of the other things I learned in that month of silence was perhaps to redefine silence. And there's a silence that you carry within you, which is not unrelated to, but can remain guarded while the outside of you and the rest of the world is very noisy.
And when you found that place you'd like to be, I'd like you to just allow yourself to sit down and take in all the surroundings, such that every sensation is heightened.
I just think of, like, memories and just things that calm me down, and then I become silent and still. Because sometimes I can go quite hyper.
Because sometimes thoughts running in your head, you feel half asleep, but you're really daydreaming, you're not sleeping. It's not restful.
It's entirely typical that even though we sit in the Dean's vestry surrounded by all this wood panelling, we've still got police helicopters overhead, even with the thick walls of the 18th century to protect us.
One of the things they talked about actually was that when you're in that zone with a kind of a client or whatever, silence is much a part. Like when they have to redefine music at the beginning, music doesn't actually mean, it doesn't mean melodic music or anything. It can be just any noises. So a patient or a client clicking something or even scratching their head really kind of like violently, it's music. And silence is just as valid. It's as much a kind of a statement as making noise. Which is kind of really interesting in a way, you know. Again, you know, we're all kind of, in that sense, we're all going around making this music really as loud as we can.
So if you touch things, you will feel those things more than you've ever felt them before.
I think it's very hard not to be introspective, and if you're a kind of person who's quite manically driven by work, you know, we often see those people and think, you know, what's driving that? And there's an implication that there's some part of them they don't want to go near. And I suppose in still moments, it's harder to stop those parts of your mind coming out, which is probably linked to the whole creativity bit as well. It's more parts of your mind are allowed to come to the fore. I presume maybe that would lead to being more kind of have the TV on, have something on where your mind can focus to stay away from looking backwards into itself. Or, I mean, I don't really know how the mind works, but it's sort of something like that.
You will be able to smell beautiful things, see vibrant colours.
The most profound effect that physical silence can have on a person is to take away distraction and also to highlight the internal monologue, dialogue, riot, party that's going on inside most of us a lot of the time. So when we remove the necessity to speak or the necessity to listen to sound, radio, television, etc., conversation, when we remove all of that, the internal sounds get some airtime. They get some chance to play in our heads and in our hearts. It's a curious paradox that in silence, in an extended period of silence, it seems to be quite noisy inside.
I have a song called Serotonin. It's kind of just holds essentially pretty much one note for like 5 or 6 minutes, and it's a stream of consciousness kind of thing, even though it's actually all totally crafted, but it's kind of delivered in the style of somebody just kind of rocking back and forth, I always think, just kind of falling over the end of the lines and starting new ones. I think there's a line in the song, well, I'm going to move to the country and turn off the televisions and this kind of stuff. It's kind of that idea of getting away from all the stimulus, getting away from a million and one things.
And hear noises that are clear and pleasing to the ear.
Because I live in the centre of a big city, I'm surrounded by sound all the time, and I do get frustrated by it. It's probably also born of a bit of frustration. And again, this obsessive, repetitive sound that we have of that actually services a market economy. So transporting goods around all the time as fast as possible is very important to keeping the whole great show on the road. All of that sound seemed to me to be expressing a nihilism that we have got to in society, where we're fast is good and loud is usually quite good, and we're using it as an escape mechanism to escape what? And what I want to suggest is to escape death. But it's futile. So the task, if you like, for society is to slow down as a collective, not just as an individual, to slow down and to stop and to face death, to face our death and to accept our death. So even over the traffic, you can still hear the birds, and it's beautiful, you can hear it.
Staying deeply, deeply relaxed. And you may want to suggest something to yourself, something positive.
This tiny, kind of secluded little place. We sometimes open that little gate and just sit out there as well. But, sometimes what's nice about here is you've kind of got the main road there, so I can kind of, well, a bit down the hill. You can sit out here, you think, and then you just decide to walk out the gate and you're not back for 2 hours. And it's, what are we hearing up there? Birds, sky, trees, traffic in the distance. Sort of. I don't really hear half of that, actually. I quite like the sound of the trains, though. Every now and again, you hear the train going past in the distance. And I had this bit in the song where the beat ran out on the drum machine anyway. And I had this gap for ages that I didn't know what to do, and had one of those great moments where I realised that the lyric just acknowledges that the beat has run out. But then it goes, oh, my God, I wish this brain would stop. And the whole beat stops and then just goes, and start again.
So it's a beautiful, tranquil day by the River Thames here, nice and still. And I think that does help with the atmosphere that's obviously created in the school. When a boy learns to connect with his innermost stillness, he connects with a vitality and an energy which is obviously going to explode when it gets out onto the playing field, and also when it can be focused and concentrated in the classroom. Does remarkable things. The biggest educational challenge at the moment, in my view, is what I call the attention deficit syndrome. It's not just some boys or girls who have trouble with their attention. It's the vast majority because of the world in which we live.
So to give them something other is to give them a skill for life and a taste of something greater.
That's the wake-up mechanism. At the end of the timer, the feet return to their resting position and there's a vibration in their lower back and the music stops.
When you're ready, count yourself back up from 1 to 10.
Real silence is really threatening and difficult. And my suggestion is that that's because we're afraid of our own death. We haven't come to terms with our own frailty, fragility, mortality.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, aware of your breathing. 7, 8, open your eyes. 9, 10.
This train is the Southern service.
Fully wide awake, fully back in the real world.
Good. Have a good day. We'll take collective quiet time. Collective.
You were just listening to Still Points Turning Worlds by London-based radio producer Alan Hall. My name is Tani Katenjian, and I'm the editor-in-chief of The Unobserved, an online radio magazine that gathers, selects, and presents some of the best radio and audio from around the world. If you'd like to learn more about The Unobserved, learn more about whom you heard today, explore other pieces there, or receive the magazine, please visit theunobserved.com. You're listening to WGXC 90.7 FM, Accra, Transmission Arts, on air. Thank you.